Good evening. We're very pleased tonight on Tube Talk to be joined by Rich Lee. Rich is an avid collector, radio repairman, president of the New Jersey Antique Radio Club. Thanks for joining us, Rich. And Rich was telling me that the Jersey Club was fortunate enough to actually have Danny Stiles present to them one time. So I don't know what could be more cool than that. And I also have to tell you, I checked out your site, and I think you guys have one of the coolest logos for the New Jersey Antique Radio Club that I've seen for any club. So kudos to you on that. Thanks for being on, Rich.
Good evening, Paul. So happy to be here with you. Wonderful. And you speak of our logo, and you have to thank our illustrious webmaster for coming up with that logo so many years ago. His name is Dave Sika. He's a wonderful guy, and he's another dedicated member.
Now, I tell you, when you said that name, it reminded me, because one of the other things I noticed on your site is you guys have some nifty pictures of members sort of now and thens, you know, in the rearview mirror, I think it said. And you got pictures of the guys. I remember that name.
Yeah, and he has, because he has control of the website, he does have a few pictures of himself as a young lad. Very interesting, yeah.
Well, I'm very fortunate in that a few pictures have survived, and that's a good thing for me. Hey, you know, it was funny because I came into the studio, and, you know, we knew we were going to talk to Rich tonight, but a local listener, very loyal, who's always listening and sending me things, sent me a little thing out of the New York Daily News, so I'm going to go off script here a little bit, Rich. Just give me a second, but you know, I'm not really sure. Maybe you could tell me if this has gone by or not. I think it might have gone by, but
Is it David Hinckley's column?
Yes, it was. David Hinckley's. And it's the last waltz this weekend for the Friends of Old Time Radio down in Newark, I guess. And they've been running that for years and years, and it was sort of a celebration of old-time radio, and there were dealers there who would sell you nostalgia and CDs, I guess, and tapes. And what do you think killed it off? Did you hear anything, Rich? Was it just lack of interest or just some of the people who participate in getting a little up there in years?
Well, all of the above. Well, you're absolutely right. It was 26 years' worth. I had attended it once. A former president had attended it also. And in all reality, you know, the Lone Ranger, who knows the Lone Ranger on radio? They know it on TV, but they don't know it on radio. And the people that put this together, well, they're no longer with us.
Yeah.
And it was getting to the point where it was a struggle just to get people there, let alone have a convention of 3 days.
Yeah, I know.
So,
it's tough going.
They pulled the plug on it this time, and this was the last one. I did not attend myself, but I heard it was good.
Well, those can be really fun. We have something up here, and I don't know if it's ongoing anymore. We had one. They had it at one of the local colleges, and it was a similar type scene where they'd have some folks, you know, do a script recreation and with the live audience and the whole thing. And for a few years, I guess he lived up in this area. Fred Foy, who was the announcer on The Lone Ranger, used to participate, and I guess Fred has gone off as well. So anyway, they were fun things while they lasted. Rich, why don't you give us a little background, give us our audience here a little general information on the New Jersey Club. When did you guys get it started, and how big are you now? How many members? I know you're very active. Maybe give us a little background on the club itself.
Of course, Paul. Well, we go back quite a ways, myself not included, but it was started by a gentleman named Tony Flanagan. The first meeting he ever held was July 16th, 1992, at the Monmouth County Library in New Jersey. And Tony was, you know, the forefather of the club, and he had gotten to the point where he got tired of leaving the state of New Jersey to find radios and to find swampies.
Sure.
So he realized that, well, there's got to be radio collectors in New Jersey, and I'm going to find them. And what he did was put out feelers and put out advertisements in the local newspapers that he would like to start a club. And that's exactly what he did. So on this night of July 16th, 1992, 15 involved people came and joined and said, we want to be part of your club. And from there, it just grew. And within a year, because right now I'm looking at the New Jersey Antique Radio Club's newsletter of March 1993, Volume 1, Number 1, and at that moment there were 60 members. So it grew very rapidly. And as of today, we have a little over 200 at the moment.
Oh, that's great.
And they're from all over the country. I can't say we have anybody international right now. Oh, wait, no, we do have a member in Japan.
Oh, that's cool.
We used to live in New Jersey. And we come from all walks of life. We have people that work at Walmart, and we have a college professor, as a matter of fact, Professor Mike Littman, who's enabled us to have our meetings 6 months of the year held at Bowen Hall at Princeton University, which is a humbling experience for yours truly to be able to conduct the club meeting at Bowen Hall in a lecture study hall in Princeton University.
Well, that's pretty amazing. Cool. Never thought you'd Absolutely. Be a professor at Princeton, huh?
Not at all. Well, the lowly electrical informant.
well, hey, I tell you, I noticed you got a couple of things coming up. You have a meeting, like it sounds like one of your regular meetings, coming up on November 11th at Bowen Hall. And then you've got a fall swap, which sounds like it's a little bit of a bigger thing, maybe open to the public, on the 19th. And that is that where you have it, at InfoAge?
No, it's a little different.
Okay. Well, fill us in.
Our Friday meeting, the 11th of November, is our normal meeting for the month of November, and that will be at InfoAge.
I see.
And we try to alter that for the demographics of people traveling from one part of New Jersey to the other.
Sure, make it easy.
The InfoAge is more at the Belmar, Jersey Shore location.
I see.
Whereas Princeton is more westerly in the center of the state. Our swap meet is north of all of that, and that's in Parsippany.
Parsippany, yep. I see it here now, yep.
Probably it's just due west of New York City, out of Route 80. And it's a confluence of large interstates, Route 80 to 87, New York State Thruway.
Sure.
And it's a very easy place to get to.
Well, that should be a good draw.
The state area. Yeah, and that's why we have it there. It's at the PAL building. And, you know, of course, to do some advertising, everyone is welcome. And go to our website, njarc.org, and you will see a flyer. And it'll tell you exactly how to get there with a map from wherever direction you're coming from. But we average about between 50 and 60 vendors, and we have them once in the fall and once in the spring. And we also have a tailgate swap meet at InfoAge, and that's outside on their grounds. I'll tell you a little about InfoAge. We're very, very fortunate to have met up with a man named Fred Carl, who is the director of InfoAge. And they are the umbrella group of a few organizations, obviously us being one of them, New Jersey Anti-Radio Club. We are able to have, within one of their buildings, our Radio and Technology Museum, which is open every Sunday between 1 and 5, and please come down. And the history of InfoAge is, it used to be known as Camp Evans, a military base.
Yeah, I noticed that on your site, yep.
And it was given over to the township, I'll say 8-9 years ago. And Fred Carl had the wherewithal to establish this learning center. And we're so fortunate to be able to have space and share space with him. We also have our swap meet on the grounds in summertime, but we also meet there in one of the buildings, 9032A, if you want to be exact. And it's just a wonderful, wonderful place.
Well, it sounds like something. Sounds like something good to kind of keep people interested as well. I see you guys had some. I looked at some of the photographs. You had some workshops there, and you know, it's a place to go and learn about the whole communication age. And you guys have a presence down there, which is really cool. It's super. A good way to reach out, do a little outreach.
And part of the history is the Marconi Hotel, where Signore Marconi was transmitting in the early part of the 20th century, 1912, 13. He built this hotel for his workers in that site too. So we've got the ghost. It's really wonderful to be able to be down there.
That's pretty neat. We have a Marconi site up here. What's left of one, really? It's on the National Seashore out in Wellfleet, on the outer arm of the Cape. And site, I guess, of one of the first, you know, that big spark gap generator up there, and one of the first transmissions of a message across the Atlantic. And it's a neat place to go up and visit. The National Park Service has a little booth set up there and a model of what the real station looked like. All that's really left due to erosion and, you know, the ocean is some bricks, a few pieces of wood, and some chain that they use to secure the thing. But you have to go up there and look out over the Atlantic and kind of put yourself back in time and think about it. And it's a pretty amazing feat when you go back to those days to think about communicating, you know, wireless, you know, across the Atlantic. It's a wild thing to think about. One of the things I noticed you do at your swap meet, you had some neat stuff that goes on, not just buying and selling, but you do a like a radio repair thing as well, and I thought that was kind of neat. Maybe you could. What kind of response do you get to that? Do you get some folks who come out with stuff they want to have repaired?
Well, what we do is we offer repair services. We have a limited number of fellows that will work on people's radios for a price, of course. But in addition to that, what we also run four times a year are what we call radio repair clinics, and they are held at InfoAge on that facility. And we invite our members and the public and our experts to help each other and to help the general public to come and give an idea of what their radio can do, if it can be repaired, if it's worth being repaired. Can we get it going right then and there? We will. And just give them an idea. And they're very appreciative. And, of course, it's a PR move by us because we always want to see new members.
Right, and it builds a little goodwill, too. And it's a great feature to have because one of the most common questions I'm asked when people, you know, find out I collect or I'm talking about it, well, where can I get something fixed? You know, how can I find somebody? And usually the first thing I'll try to tell them is, if you're lucky enough and you have a good active club, go find your local radio club, your antique radio club or your ham club. You'll get a good lead on somebody who can help you. And then I will mention, you know, you can look at ARC. They have folks who advertise, you know, services that they'll render. And, you know, look at the Radio Attic. They have a list of resources. But to have it available so you can actually bring something down in person is really a nice touch. And I also noticed you had a tube committee. Apparently you have a tube program for the club. That I thought also was a very handy service to have available.
Well, over time what's happened is people have donated tubes, and we've done clean-outs, as everybody's done. We put them in some storage. We shut the lights off. We come back a few days later, and they seem to multiply. So we have an overabundance of tubes that we need to categorize and put into shape. So what we've been doing is having tubes where we can actually see what we have, do some testing, some cleaning. And again, with the facilities of InfoAge, we've managed to put ourselves together with a building, a small building, and we're using that as a storage locker. And we have different members who have volunteered their time to test and clean and bring tubes to our meetings for sale to our members at a very reasonable cost.
Well, that's very convenient.
Instead of having to go through the suppliers, we do it ourselves.
Yeah, you know, and it's funny because, again, one of the other common misconceptions, and we've discussed this before on the program, and you might run into the same thing yourself when you're talking to somebody who's not familiar with the hobby, you know, sort of the first thing people say is, well, you know, I've got this old radio at home, and I think a tube burned out. You know, maybe I can fit, you know, they think you can just fix it by replacing a tube, and usually the tubes are the least of your worries. You've got, you know, capacitors, you've got wiring issues, you might have a transformer problem, you could have, you know, rubber insulation on the wiring. There's a lot of different things that you'd have to look at that might require some attention, but usually your tubes are not going to be something you have to worry about too much. And the other great thing is, you know, people will say, well, where do you find them? And, you know, certainly there are, you know, resources online, and there are retailers, and you'll find folks who sell them at swap meets. We have a couple of guys who are merchants. And a great resource, too, for people who might not be familiar with the hobby is I know a lot of guys will look at a little, you know, 5-tube All-American 5, and it's kind of beat up and the cabinet's bashed. And, well, hey, if the price is right, they'll look at that and they'll say, you know what, if those are 5 tubes that'll test good, that might be worth me just grabbing. You know, maybe I can use the chassis for parts, but I can take those tubes, we'll clean them up, test them, and if they're good, put them in the box, you know, because I could use those someday.
Oh, absolutely. And we're called out many times, myself in particular, to what we call radio rescues, go on radio rescues, where we're out combing a barn, a basement, somebody's garage, perhaps, say, the widow of a collector, and she or he would like to depart with the collection. And sometimes we call it junk, J-U-N-Q-U-E, but it's something that we just can't let go in the dumpster. So we're out there and we're getting the stuff. And like you say, when you find it, it needs to be categorized and saved for the future, because pretty much they're not making any more other than in China or in Russia, but that's for us, maybe for the audiophile.
Yeah, you know, it's funny because I had to run in on my way over to the studio. We're very fortunate up here in the greater Boston area. We have a great store, You Do It Electronics, and they are a throwback store, I've got to tell you. They have three floors. They can sell you the latest in TV, the latest in DJ equipment, radio, phones. They've got it all. They have an unbelievable parts supply downstairs in their basement. You've got wire, you've got microphones, earphones, batteries, soldering. They've got everything. It's a full service. Think of an antique electronic supply, but at a retail level you can go into. And these guys, actually, I'm thrilled. They've got a setup now in their lobby, and they showcase old vintage tube equipment in this closed-up showcase. And they actually had a display of radio tubes for sale. And as you were mentioning, I asked the guy, I said, hey, do you got any radio-type tubes? He goes, no. He says, you won't believe it's coming back so strong now. People want tubes for their amplifiers, musicians. And he had a lot of stuff there. Some was new old stock stuff made here, but some of it was the imports from overseas. But it was just nice to see that it's back, you know. I said, wow, that's pretty cool. You know, who thought they'd be putting those displays back together again, you know? So
that's marvelous. Yeah, we don't can't say I've seen anything like that here in New Jersey or in New York City. We do have one member who runs what his name of his shop is Waves, and he's in New York City, and he's one of the only retailers that I know of that does sell radio and amplification equipment in New York City.
Well, I'll tell you what, if you ever get up this way, put it on your list, because it's worth the trip. I would just like to take a quick minute here to remind everybody you're listening to Tube Talk on WRCA. You have reached the zenith of independently produced radio programming, and we appreciate you being with us tonight. From Arvin to Zenith, this is the show for you, the collector, for the folks who like to listen to music and hear good conversation about the great old days of radio. And I appreciate you joining Rich and I. We're in the comfy, cozy radio parlor here. We've got the blackout curtains drawn. We've got a nice fire going. After the show, we're going to listen to some Margaret Whiting. I've got a big RCA 281 here, a beauty of a console. And as it says in the ad that I've got here for the radio, thrilling foreign reception, superb tone, a cabinet of rare beauty. And it's just got to be true, because that's what it said in the ad from RCA in 1934. Anyway, thanks for joining up with the folks up in New England here, and people listen all around the country. I've got a few people I know who listen and then rebroadcast. They'll pick it up on the computer, send it to their home transmitter, and then play it on their vintage equipment. So people go to great lengths to listen to us, and we certainly appreciate that. Rich, maybe you could give us a little idea how you got into the hobby yourself. When did you get started in radio?
I came late to it myself. I had mentioned that I'd been an electrician most of my life. But I actually came to radio as from the design point of view. I've always appreciated the Art Deco design of the period, the 20s and 30s. And I enjoyed the industrial designers of that era, the machine age. It's something I've always enjoyed looking at, streamlined. And so I came to that. I've always owned radios just for the design. Whether they worked or not, it didn't matter to me, until one day I realized that, you know, I think I can fix one of those. I am an electrician. I should be able to do that.
Sure.
And lo and behold, I wasn't able to fix it. But, but then resources. Yes, indeed. But then I found resources to that. And during the period of time I was living in, Philadelphia area, and of course the history of Philadelphia and Philco, RCA across the river, I realized that I was in the bastion of radio.
That's right, hallowed radio ground down there.
Hallowed radio ground. And I had been to a few flea markets and picked up some radios. And with that, I met up with some people that told me about a club. And wasn't in Pennsylvania at the time. It was called the New Jersey Antique Radio Club. And from then on, we're talking probably 95, 96 on, that's when I became extremely involved. And I've never looked back since. It's just absolutely wonderful.
Yeah. I found this old set in one of my great uncles passed away. We found this great old Silvertone 6-tube, nice, pretty cabinet, nice wood set. And my dad took me to get it fixed. I couldn't get it. It played for a little bit, then it just went. So he said, "We'll go see this guy." As I mentioned to you, my father worked for Edison, and he was one of these greatest generation guys, World War II guys. He had a friend of his who was a mechanic for the Edison. He was an auto mechanic, but he was also a radio operator and repair guy in the war. So we go over there, and I give him the radio, and he kind of looks it over. He's one of these guys with the slick back hair and the pocket T-shirt, and, you know, he could fix anything. He was not afraid of anything. He was jump right in. He says, "Oh, we should be able to do this." So he tested the tubes and changed one. He charged me $1.50, and I think he might have taken out a couple of capacitors too, but I was just mesmerized by watching him do this. In about 20 minutes, he's got the thing fired up and running. And, you know, from there, I got to say, just, you know, that's how I got hooked. But anyway, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to digress from your point there when you were getting more interested. Do you actually do the repair work yourself now? You've become quite adept?
Yes, I do. Yes.
Excellent.
Yes. I'm far from being the expert, but we have experts who have been living radio repair all their lives. So I bend to them, and part of that is at our repair clinics, we have our experts showing up, and we have a few fellows that can just diagnose a radio within 30 seconds. Absolutely amazing, the talent that we have. And speaking of talent, New Jersey, and I'm sorry, I'm going to have to push New Jersey because
it's okay.
Again, that was the fertile crescent of radio in the 1920s. We had Edison Radio, Splittorff Radio, Victor Radio, the precursor to RCA Radio, Fried Eisman, Broad Radio, Radio Service Laboratories, Cornell Dubilier, Colster, Metropolitan Radio.
Lafayette was out of New York, right? Emerson was in New York.
Emerson was in New York and New Jersey.
Yeah, New Jersey.
And one of our members is named Ben Tung of Blonder Tung Company, who was a FM radio producer and TV channel booster and VHF booster.
Well, that's marvelous.
Anything TV. So we have an amazing amount of talented people that have joined us, too. And it's just by being in this environment, being so close to New York City, the radio business of New York City, and the radio business of Newark, New Jersey.
So not to mention all the entertainment, too, that was centered around those nightclubs and Broadway and singers and just, you know, Tin Pan Alley. It's just a hotbed. It's an incredible area. And, you know, when you were mentioning your time in Philadelphia, I was, if you're familiar with Ron Ramirez's philcoradio.com site.
Yes, I have his book.
He's got some photographs of himself down near the old Philco plants, you know, what was left of them. You know, some of them were torn down, but some of them were still in existence when he took the photos and stuff. And it's kind of sad that, you know, it's all gone. But it was great to see, because I have a weakness towards RCA. It was great to see that the Nipper building in Camden actually got saved. And I don't know if it's mixed use for, dwellings as well as businesses, but I saw them restoring the stained glass up at the in the top of the tower, and I said, you know, if nothing else survived, just the fact that that building and Nippers up there, I said, that's really cool. I like that a lot.
It is. It's impressive to go over the bridge and see it, and I believe Rutgers University took over part of that that building. Like I said, spending time down there, I did investigate a few things, and of course the original glass, the Nipper, is taken out, and I believe now it's a plexiglass replica. But it's to be there. You have to realize that during World War II, there was 50,000 people employed
sure.
in RCA in Camden, all right? And I don't know how many in Philco, but probably it's about the same number. As a matter of fact, Philo Farnsworth was there doing his TV and his experiments. And,
now, the RCA had a tube plant as well. Was it in Harrison or Harrisonburg?
Yes, Harrison, which is a suburb of Newark.
I see.
And as a matter of fact, if you've ever heard of the soccer stadium called Red Bull Stadium,
or yes.
the soccer team Red Bull, probably half of their parking lot and stadium is what the Harrison RCA plant was on. There are still buildings there, though, and still addresses that you can go see of the tube manufacturing facilities that they had in Harrison. It's ghosty, but it's interesting.
That's great.
I believe the last tube manufactured there was in 1976.
That's cool. I know a fellow up in, I'm going to have him on the show sometime. He runs a website, Vintage Tube Services. He's up in Michigan, and he caters a little bit more to the audio tube customer. But he's got a test bench that's on his website, and he's got some equipment that they actually, I don't know if he went to auctions when they were closing down some of the RCA facilities, but he's got some of their factory testing stuff. It's really cool stuff. And he also has some magnificent pictures from some of the tube manufacturers. He's got corporate pictures from Tungsol, RCA, Sylvania. It's fun stuff to check out, and it's really fascinating, and it's a big part of, you know, American industrial history. And the other thing that a lot of people I talk to don't seem to have an appreciation of is back in the day, you know, when they were building radio equipment on the East Coast, you know, it was prolific. I mean, you had these centers. It seemed geographical. You know, there was a cluster of manufacturers around the Chicago area, but then you had the New Jersey, New York scene. You know, Stromberg Carlson was up, I think, in Rochester. You had all the activity and all that whole list of manufacturers you were rattling off in the New Jersey area. And then there was, you know, Packard Bell, and I think, I don't know if Gilfillan was out on the West Coast, but there were companies that were out there as well. And it was almost sort of based on, I don't know how much distribution had to come into it, but it was interesting. There were these clusters of all this activity where the electronics, you know, research as well as the, you know, design and production of the consumer radios was going on. So it's an interesting part of history, and it's something to keep alive. And I think it's too easy to say, you know, we can't do it anymore. Or, you know, not only did we do it, we did a lot of this stuff during and right after the Depression, which makes this whole scene even more remarkable to me. So just another reason I find it an interesting hobby. Do you favor any particular manufacturers in your collection, or are you more of a collector by style? I know you say the Art Deco period is close to your heart, but do you like a Philco better than an RCA, or are you more of a Zenith guy, or do you have a favorite?
I do. I'm a Stromberg Carlson guy. That's
really
what I seem to prefer. Yeah.
Very cool.
I like their product. I like the design. I own a few of them. Some working, some not. But there's always that potential that they will be working someday.
Well, they're good to work on, built like battleships, strong chassis, and just really put together. My sister found a 430M console model, which is from, I think, about 1939, at the end of a guy's driveway with a sign on it that said, for free. So throws the thing in the back of her trunk there and brings it over to me, and I got to tell you, it's amazing. It's a big speaker. It's got the RCA jack. It's very cool Art Deco numbering on the dial glass. I enjoy it. I can't tell you how much I enjoy it. I also have a 440M that I rescued from a guy who was going to throw it out, which is in various stages. I got to do some cabinet work on it. But they were built very solid, and they were great receivers, and the sound was great. And they had a great reputation, and apparently they made a lot of telephone equipment as well, from what I understand.
Yes, they did, yeah. I myself own a 145 console that is it's a monster. It's a beautiful set, and it has what they call the Labyrinth speaker system.
Yes, Acoustical Labyrinth, yep.
Yes, and it has the face of it is beautiful when it's lit, but when you look at it, you realize what they were getting at was this is a 1936 set, and what they're looking at is the future. They're looking at the future of television, and you're realizing that it's more of a CRT screen you're looking at than a radio dial, and you know, it's like the futurism of the set coming through. I just acquired something, if I might tell you, that maybe your radio listener audience could help me out with. I would appreciate.
They're out there, so you tell them where they can reach you. Do you have a web address you'd like to share with them?
Well, my email address is president@njarc.org.
Very good.
And that's probably the best way to get a hold of me.
Okay, and what do you need help with, Rich? Because we're here to help.
Good.
We'll try.
We're one big happy family.
That's it.
All right. This is something special, and I do mean special. I recently acquired an E.H. Scott special communications receiver. Now, yeah, I hear the silence because it's not something people know very well. It was a communication receiver built in 1940-41, limited production because it was custom built.
Sure, there were high-end stuff and just the top of the top.
Right. As a communication receiver by Mr. Scott. Now, why did Mr. Scott build this? He built it that he proved to the military and to his other customers that he, too, could build a communication receiver. All right? He built this for himself, one of them, and then X amount for other customers. One of the amazing pieces of information on this radio is that it is two radios in one. It is both a receiver of broadcast, medium wave, and of shortwave in one chassis, two receivers.
And very interesting.
Since it's a Scott, it has, because it is Mr. Scott, it's the only communication receiver built with a treble and bass control.
Very interesting.
Yeah. It's 22 tubes, outside power supply, obviously, and a rather bizarre-looking speaker enclosure.
Hmm.
Now, anybody could give me information on this. It's within the Dean of the X book, both one and two, all of two pages of information. I have talked to Mr. John Slusser, who has a vast collection
Radio Days,
of E.H. Scott for Radio Days, and his son Mike, great guys. And I'm looking for information. It's very little information out there. Mr. Pewitt, if you remember those books, he did the Ghost of Radio, having to do with E.H. Scott, and he has some more information. But otherwise, you can go out and Google it, Bing it, and it's very, very little information out there. I've been told that there were as many as 25 made and as little as 12 made. So I'm very, very interested in getting as much information on this radio as possible.
Okay, gang, you have your marching orders. If anybody out there knows something about this and can help Rich out, email him courtesy of the New Jersey Antique Radio Club. And, Rich, I'd like to thank you for being on. It's been great. The time always flies when we have some interesting discussion on radio, thus the name Tube Talk. And we'll have to have you on again sometime. Thanks again for being on. It was great to chat with you. Have a great night.
Paul, it's been a real pleasure. Anytime, any place, I'd be happy to come back.
Super. Have a good one now.